This is Limit Up, the place where we explore markets, strategies, and trading psychology to take your trading to the next level.
Traders, this is Eddie Horn from Top Step, and this is Limit Up. This is where we talk with traders, market participants, and trading psychologists to help you improve your trading. We've had a lot of new listeners join over the past few months, so we're taking a couple weeks to replay some of our favorite episodes. This week, we're replaying our conversation with Jack Schwager, the market wizard whisperer himself. And I hope you enjoy this interview with Jack Schwager. It's a complete honor and an envy for many to introduce my guest, Jack Schwager, author, trader, and I guess you could say hero to many. Now, Jack is recognized in the industry as an expert in futures and hedge funds. He is the author of a number of widely acclaimed financial books. Mr. Schwager is one of the founders of FundSeeder, FundSeeder.com, a platform designed to find undiscovered trading talent worldwide and connect unknown successful traders with sources of investment capital. And I'd like to say, Jack, welcome to our Limit Up podcast.
Oh, thank you, Eddie. Glad to be here.
Now, Jack, let's start out, let's go back a bit. The very beginning of your career, now you're filled with knowledge. You're an icon of knowledge. And what I want to know, and what probably a lot of listeners want to know, is how you got there. What was it a passion? Was it a hobby? Where did it begin, Jack?
Well, it happened by chance, really. So I was out of graduate school for a degree in economics and just really looking for an analytical job. And it to not go into the long story, but just bottom line, put an ad in the paper. I got tired of dealing with employment agencies. After about 2 weeks, you know, I had a short patience span, like I always have had.
Right. Anyway,
so I tried to take things in my hand. Back in those days, you could put the New York Times at a help position wanted, not help wanted, a position wanted section, and I put in a short ad, just you know, saying, graduate degree, Brown, minor, you know, major economics, minor math. Looking for an analytical job, period. You know, like whatever the minimum was, how many words it was allowed, which was less than the original tweet limit. That led to a number of calls, only one legitimate call. And that legitimate call ended up to my getting a job as a commodity research analyst. And that position actually, the position I took was a position being vacated by Michael Marcus, who ended up years later being chapter one in the first Market Wizards book. That's how we met. I was taking the job he was leaving to, in quotes, become a trader. He was very successful in becoming a trader, obviously. So that's how I got. So I fell into it really knowing absolutely nothing. I knew nothing about futures. I knew nothing about trading. I had never thought about a career in the markets. It was just the job sounded good, interesting, not financially remunerative, but it sounded interesting. Mm-hmm. It was analytical. And I was in a job for, you know, a couple of weeks and realized, hey, you know, the research we were putting out, at least in futures, was not terribly good. And I said, well, you know, boy, it shouldn't be easy to excel here. This has nothing to do with trading. This is just a matter of, you know, just the analysis. And that's how I got in. So once I was doing market analysis, that got me interested in trading, and that's basically how it began.
Now, Jack, you've developed into a serious student of the markets, and I think we all try to follow that guideline. In addition to Market Wizard's book, you wrote Complete Guide to Futures Markets, Getting Started in Technical Analysis, and the other books. Now, as you've learned the trials, tribulations, the positives, the negatives, what goes into good trading, and what's a safe, simple, and successful formula for trading?
Well, there is no formula. In fact, the concept that there is a formula is actually, I think, very misguided. So what I always tell people, and this is, you know, this I've seen this through all these decades of interviewing traders repeatedly, good traders don't have, didn't find a formula like reading a book or something like that, whether my book or any other book. They basically got, they get information from different sources, they may learn from different people, but ultimately they develop their own methodology. And there are two kind of core elements to any successful trader. One, they've developed a core method, their own methodology, which has some edge. It doesn't have to be a large edge, but it has to have some edge. If there's no edge, then there's no way you can win over the long term. And secondly, they've learned risk management. So I'd say those are the two essential ingredients. And so you have to develop, your own success, your own methodology that has some sort of edge. And I don't care if it's purely fundamental, purely technical, some combination of the two, short-term, long-term, futures trading, stock trading, give me a million different variations. I don't care. Like, any of them could work as long as it's kind of what is right for you, what would you gravitate towards and find works, and you've combined with money management. And the approaches are totally, totally different. I mean, some of the fundamental guys I've interviewed have complete disdain for chart analysis, never used it, think it's just a bunch of nonsense.
Right.
And some of the pure technical guys I've interviewed, talk about how they just lost money on fundamentals and finally made a lot of money trading technicals. And there's people who combine the two. It's like somebody like a Kovner who's heavily fundamental and could talk to you. When I talk, it could have discussed the intricacies of the economies of any developed nation and probably some undeveloped ones. But he would also look at charts, whether he talked about them. Well, he did talk about it to some extent, but he basically used both. So it doesn't really make a difference as long as it's right for you. You could take somebody, we took somebody like Rogers, who's just pure long-term fundamentals, give him charts, and it's only, first of all, he's not going to pay attention to it, but if you ever tried using it, he would be negative. So you have to find your own approach. And again, the money management I come back to, because most, especially novice traders, don't really understand this, that it's not so much the trading methodology that's absolutely critical to trading survival, but it's the money management.
Yeah, I have to agree 100% with you. And with the management. Management is so important. You need to not only manage your account, but you have to manage yourself. You have to be the boss, and you have to make the right decisions. And sometimes it's really tough, and sometimes you've got to ask yourself questions and have answers and proceed forward. Now, you mentioned the edge, and I had an interview, did a podcast with Blair Hull, and that was something that he put out in front as this is very important. He had the advantage, the edge, something that would only give him a green light. And it wasn't very seldom. It was very rare. So it wasn't a situation where, just one after another, they talk about the one trade, the sniper trade, one trade, wait all day for it, take advantage of that. Now, having the edge, you talk to a lot of people, you talk to a lot of successful traders. Has this edge evolved over years, or are we going back and taking that edge and just bringing it through trading history, saying that, it's plain and simple. If you don't understand this, you're in the wrong business.
Well, it's not so much evolved as it depends. Well, it has in some sense. I mean, certainly you take somebody like Ed Thorpe, who was probably the longest interview, at least the longest written interview I had in any of the books. And he went through many phases, but he kind of discovered his, so his edge was, he was the first guy, he mathematically came up with an equivalent of the Black-Scholes option pricing model.
Right.
Quite a few years before that article ever came out. So for a period, and he didn't publish it, even though he had a math degree. He just, PhD. He wasn't interested in publishing. He was interested in using it. So for many years there, he was kind of just printing money because he was probably one of the only people in the world who actually knew how to price options. So that was a great advantage, But anyway, as option markets became more efficient, he ultimately gravitated. He did statistical arbitrage in the air and involved that. Convertible arbitrage. basically kept on finding different financial approaches where the market was mispriced or had some. See, he kind of figured out that the market was not pricing things correctly, and he found multiple ways in his career how to do it. So that's kind of an example of somebody personally evolving. And of course, it also is the market's evolving, because as these techniques are discovered, some of them, they get arbitraged away. That's in that case. But in other cases, if it's somebody who's just inherently a good trader, that's a personal thing. That's not something that's arbitraged away.
Right. So that goes back to patience and discipline, which is something that...
Those are elements. There are many elements of it, but certainly patience, this patience and discipline are certainly two critical ones. Patience to, like you use a term, sniper trade. The idea is to wait for the right trade and not to be tempted to trade just for the sake of trading, but to wait until things are really set up exactly right, so the probabilities are in your favor. And it's also patience to stay with a trade, which is difficult to do. People, when they're right, are tempted to take a profit. And to really make a lot of money on a trade, you've got to stay with it for a length of time. And some of the traders who really made a lot of money have been able to do that.
Okay. Now, Jack, what have you recognized as one of the biggest market evolutions, taking a look at the big picture?
Well, I mean, it's hard to ignore the computer, right? I started in the business when there were no even laptops, right? So we go from no computers at all. There were IBM mainframes, which took up a whole-sized room, and you had to do punch cards. But go back to the early days. Literally, that was the state of the computers at that stage. And you go from that where just anybody can have tremendous computing power at their fingertips for a couple of $1,000. And so of course, then you have the quant shops who have massive computing power. So that, I guess, is the biggest change. And what that does is that opens up lots of strategies which would have been impossible to execute because they just required massive computing power, which didn't exist. So the very emergence of computing power itself leads to strategies which were impossible, let's say, if you go back to my starting days. That kind of leads to certain things becoming obsolete more quickly, if they're purely quant-based. And so it does change the nature of the markets, but some of the underlying things don't change, because markets, bottom line, are still driven by human emotions.
Right.
And so you still get bubbles, and you still get, busts, and, you get prices, markets overshooting in both directions, and you still get all of these things because they're part of human nature. And as long as it's humans trading markets, that part is still there, and that leads to certain opportunities. And also, human nature has certain weaknesses, which mean that most people will lose money. But people who learn the weaknesses of human nature and deal with it have an advantage.
Right. Yeah. When I was on the trading floor, I think beginning of my career, the only computers we had there were the computers for time and sales. And then, it started to evolve where we had electronic trading circled around the S&P pit. And, the open outcry was like, how are these guys going to be able to trade? Now, the shoe's on the other foot. And, with all the information we have in front of us now, it's, we are trading. We are trying to sell the high, buy the low. But there's just so much information out there right now. Now, Jack, you're one of the founders of FundSeeder, FundSeeder.com. Well, now, we share a belief that a good trader can be found anywhere.
So first of all, I don't ever take credit for what isn't mine. So it wasn't my idea. The company was founded by three partners: myself, Emmanuel Vallari, who's the CEO, and James Bibbings, who's the chief operating officer. Anyway, but it was Emmanuel Vallari's, he was the one who had the original idea. And when he told me about it, I met him because I was advising a multi-manager fund for ADM Financial Services, and he was with them and had a subsidiary of them, and that's how we knew each other. And my advisory firm, which I was with then, which is a London-based firm, got bought out, got acquired by a merchant bank in the UK. I decided to leave at that point. I was the only U.S. employee anyway. And this multi-manager thing that we were doing on the future side was my baby anyway. And so I maintained a relationship with Emmanuel and then ADM. And sort of that's how we knew each other. And the one conference we were at, he pitched this idea. And the idea was, what do you think about it? I've got this idea. And the idea was, why not create a web-based center where, traders from across the globe could, have their trade or accounts linked to and verified, and then that could be a source of finding trading talent, and then one could connect that trading talent with investors looking for emerging trading talent. The idea is that really we have evolved, the financial industry has evolved to a point where almost all the money or a vast majority of money goes to a very small number of very large hedge funds. And if you're a trader, if you're not from the US or UK, or a couple of other countries, and no matter how good you are, you're not going to have a chance in the world to get any allocations. So I'll give you, we've had signups from 120 countries. I wouldn't have guessed that there are traders in 120 countries, but we've had people register in 120 countries. And I'll give you an example. And I've been looking at and kind of interviewing some of the ones which have been really standing out. So this is one track record, and just phenomenal. And I look, by the way, we can get into this. I don't want to go into this tangent now. We can pick it up a little bit later. But I look at return risk, not return. And so there's a lot of guys there with really, really good, return risk numbers. I don't particularly use the Sharpe ratio, but most people are familiar with what a Sharpe ratio is. So let's say we're talking Sharpe ratios of 2 or 3, even though 4 even. So, but I'm looking at it through different metrics. Anyway, so like one of these traders I'm talking to, just a, 5-year record, pretty, not only just good returns, but just so smooth. And the reason we know it's real is because these accounts were getting the numbers not from the trader, we're getting it from the broker. So so we got a verified track record, just like one of those mountain charts. The number of actually traders have things like that. But so this one is like a great example. And speaking to the fellow was basically managing a hotel desk, not managing, a hotel clerk basically. Up to me, I had a passion for the market, started trading 7-8 years ago with a small amount of money. He's built it up to a couple hundred thousand.
Nice.
Guy's located in the Czech Republic. No real education. I mean, didn't finish the equivalent of college here. But yet he's developed this trading methodology, which is, I won't say more than based on trading on earnings. And he's figured out patterns in earnings that are predictive. And that's what all he trades. And so he doesn't trade that many times, for each he trades large cap stock. But he's got this magnificent record. And some kind of Czech Republic trading $200,000, which he started with 30 or something. And no real education. A guy like that wouldn't have a chance, of ever getting any allocation. So that's a perfect illustration. So the premise is, there are lots of good traders. When I say lots, I mean a number, not a percentage. The percentage of good traders out of all traders is tiny. But if you've got hundreds of thousands or even millions of traders, you don't need a large percentage to have a lot of good traders. And most of those traders won't ever have a chance of ever getting an allocation, no matter how good they are. They won't get anybody to pay attention to them, look at them, or whatever. And the idea of Fund Seeder is, hey, they can go on, they can link their account, they become visible, and they have a chance of getting actually allocations. And so, which is done through, I should say, for legal reasons, that we have a separate company, Fund Seeder Investments, which is the company that has the registrations and does the, you know, which is the one which does the investments. Fundseeder itself, Fundseeder Technologies, is basically a trader side that has all the analytics. It's what we use as our databases where we can find traders, but the actual allocations occur in a completely separate company for, you know, for compliance and legal reasons, which would which is Fundseeder Investments.
All right. Now, transitioning, I you know, coming from the trading floor, I was lucky enough to transition into electronic. There's a lot of traders in the open outcry that just couldn't do it electronically and had a very hard time and are not in the business anymore. Now, for fund seekers, what type of traders is fund seekers looking for? Is it performance or risk-adjusted returns?
Sure. So, you know, let me just for people that are looking for the site, it's Fundseeder, like seeding a crop. So, FundSeeder.com. So what we're looking, well, actually, we're pretty, as long as it's liquid, we're not looking for, you know, we're not looking for people doing, you know, illiquid type of, credit transactions or stuff like that. But anybody trading, you know, futures, FX, liquid stocks, you know, any of that. Now, as far as what's going to push them to the top, we have our own proprietary score called the FS score. That I can't even explain it in shorthand because it's a complex score. There's a lot of stuff going on. It's a return risk measure. It will take into consideration the shape of the return distribution curve. It will try to identify accounts which are vulnerable to tail risk. It will take into account the length of trades. So it's a fairly complex number. But that is the key number that determines the rankings in a leaderboard. And we have something called the FS Index, which is the top 5% of traders based on that FS score. Now, as far as we have all the return risk metrics like the Sortino, the Sharp. I've got my own measure, which I like a lot, which is the gain to pain ratio. And I should add that all our data is based on daily data, so it's a lot more meaningful than typical track records, which are monthly data. So we apply these statistics to daily data. So if you're looking at, you know, 5 years of daily data or whatever it might be, based on return risk measures, you know, well, that's no guarantee of future performance, but it does give you a really good insight to that trader's return to risk. And we also have things like underwater charts that, you know, you can see all the traders' drawdowns in graphic form, but a lot of emphasis on return to risk. We also have, of course, cumulative return, or an average annual return. I personally never look at those independently. I always look at the return risk numbers because that's all that really matters. I can always, my attitude from my, now putting on my allocation hat is, let's say if I'm an allocator for a multi-manager fund, I would basically be sizing the allocations based upon the risk anyway. So to me, there's no difference. Somebody makes 40% and has, let's say, whatever risk metrics say has a risk of 2x, and somebody making 20% having a risk of 1x, and somebody making 10% having a risk of 0.5x. Those are all equivalent to me because, you know, I'm going to size the allocations accordingly, and they'll all have the same return and the same risk. So in that simplified example, so I'm only looking at return to risk. If somebody has low, you know, very low risk and, you know, low return, you know, moderate returns, I don't care. I can leverage that trader, or not leverage, allocate more to them, and get a higher return. And if somebody has a high risk and high return, I'm going to allocate less, and so it'll all end up being the same. So the only thing that matters, the only thing that matters, is return to risk. And the thing, if anybody doubts that, I always kind of tell people this. If I give talks, I say, you know, if you want to, do you want to double your returns? I can give you a foolproof way to double your returns. And all you got to do is just double the position size of every trade you do. Now, is that going to make you twice as good of a trader? No, it hasn't changed you at all. It just means that you're going to lose twice as much when you're losing. And if you can do that, then, you know, that's fine. But bottom line, it's exactly the same track record. So all that matters is return to risk. I think just looking at pure return is kind of irrelevant.
I've been mentored by many successful traders, and you know, I treasured many of the tips, many of the directions, much of the education from these traders. And you know, with what you have done, you've written books and you've had a lot of interviews with a lot of traders. You know, the list: Richard Dennis, Paul Tudor Jones, Ed Sakota, Marty Schwartz, who my sister was his S&P phone clerk for many years.
Boy, that had to be a tough job.
What I want to ask you about the interviews that you had, the opportunities to talk to a lot of these traders, to pick their brains. What interview impacted you the most and why?
Well, you know, basically, as far as favorites, insofar as I have any favorites, I would say you can usually tell by what the first chapter is, because and that's favorite, not that's a favorite in that I think that the interview is just has a lot of interesting stuff in it. It doesn't mean it's, sure, it's necessarily the most meaningful, but it's the one that has the best combination of both advice and good stories, and it just makes a good read. There's one exception to that, I think, in Hedge Fund Market Wizards, which is the last normal format, you know, the question answer narrative and then summary, introductory and summary, the standard format I've used for my Market Wizard books. So, you know, that's how I would answer what the favorites were. As far as most influential, it's hard to say. It's kind of cumulative. I mean, just the so many traders harping on risk management and different ways of doing risk management. All of those basically had an influence. If I think of this, the line that I like to quote as maybe the most meaningful to me in terms of risk management, because it's literally one sentence and really did affect the way I trade, is, and I regret it when I don't do that, is know where you're going to get out before you get in. And that was a piece of advice by Bruce Kovner. So I guess, you know, if any single sentence in all the Market Wizard books impacted me most, that's probably that line, because I think it is just such a terrific piece of advice. And it would save a lot of people a lot of heartache and money if they followed it.
Right. You know, a lot of traders come into the trade day and, you know, the mentality is, how much money can I make? You know, the thing is, they're looking at it all wrong. It's, you got to ask yourself the question, how much money can I afford to lose?
Yeah. And that's why you figure out, and it's not so much, not only how much your money, and this is a point that one of the people, one of the hedge fund managers I interviewed in Hedge Fund Market Wizards, Colin O'Shea, made, and he said, it's not, you know, people actually get this wrong. They decide that how much money can you lose is an important question, but they go, it's in the wrong sequence. So he said a lot of people will decide how much they can lose. They have got a normal trading size, and so then they will determine their stop by, you know, how many, you know, contracts or how many shares, depending on what they're trading, you know, can, no, sorry, not how many contracts, how many shares, how much, what stop point, given my, you know, given the order size, what stop point will hit that amount? And his point was, that's all wrong. You know how much money you want to lose. Well, you know, you should know what your trading size is. What you want to determine is, separately, where should the market not go if you're right, which is also a point that Kovner and others made. And once you pick that point, then you determine your trading size, because you know how much you can lose, you know where you want to have your stop to be meaningful, and that will determine what your trading size is. That should be the last thing that you figure out. So that's an important point, as is, of course, the whole idea of picking that point before you put on the trade, as Kovner advises, because then you have complete objectivity.
It's like driving a car. Be safe, be a defensive driver.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, it's really, and it's also, it takes a lot of emotional strain out of things, right? So, but I mean, normally, if I put on a trade, at the same time I put on a trade, I will have a stop to that trade. Because I've decided, well, okay, I'm buying or selling here, and then the stop's here, and that's it. And then I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to worry, is the market going against me or not? Because there's a stop there, you know, and it's a stop that I pick before I put on the trade. And if that stop gets hit, one thing for sure, whether the trade works out long run or not, my timing sucked. You know, right. I was wrong. You know, bottom line. So either the trade was completely wrong, or it's just my timing was off. But either way, I was wrong, right? So, but so I don't have to agonize about it or worry about it because, well, if it's going to go against me, I won't be around too far, too long to have it do too much damage, and it's predetermined. So it does take a lot of the strain out of it. I think that's good advice for anybody.
Right. I'm allergic to financial pain. So same thing. You know what? I'm not going to stick around. Now, some of the performances in the books of the traders, what makes these traders special?
Well, I mean, there's no question. I mean, they're, first of all, these traders, for the most part, I always try to get people who have longer term records and sometimes very long records. But also their performances are so far from normal that it's not you just don't get that by pure luck, right? So and what makes them special is, well, it's different in every case. If it's somebody like Thorpe, he had the combination of strong mathematical ability combined with creative insight into markets and was able to combine those. If it's somebody like a Marcus, he's just somebody who has great intuitive trading sense. Somebody who could look at a market and there's 100 fundamentals and kind of can pick out the fundamental that is going to drive the market. It really depends on the person. Each person has a different talent. And then that goes to the methodology they end up using.
Okay, now, coming up in 2019, right, Market Wizards is going to have its 30th anniversary. Is there anything special planned for this?
No, there isn't. There'll be a new audio version of it.
Tell us about this audio version.
Well, first, the Market Wizard books, they all have they all have audio versions, and I didn't have control of any of them except one. Actually, the Hedge Fund Market Wizards one is good, but the one I had control over was the New Market Wizards one, and that my agent got me the audio rights back, so I was able to use ACX, which is part of Audible, and it's kind of neat, you put out a file, you know, some text for people to apply and to audition for it. And so I posted it, and like within 2-3 days I had like 40 auditions for narrating, of the sample I provided. And they were like almost all good. I would say 90% of them were at least good or better, mm-hmm. So it made it hard. But so then I started listening to some ones which were really exceptional. I got it down to like 10. And by the way, I pulled the thing off the site because I didn't want to get any more. I was like I just couldn't stand to have to go through any more of them. So I had more than enough good ones. So I got it down to 10, and I sent it to about 10 people that I knew who would, these were people like who did their own podcast, like Mike Covell or Trey, people that I, that had some reason. I had a cousin who's in public relations, et cetera, et cetera. So I got, and 8 out of 10 picked this one guy as number one or two out of the four. I sent through a sample of the four best ones that I thought. And so I took this guy, and he did a phenomenal job. So the original Market Wizards narration is okay, but it's really, I think, way inferior to what this guy did with New Market Wizards. And awesome. So I've been trying. Publishers are so difficult to deal with. My agent's been like going, I said, look, I'll pay for the narrator. Just give me the rights, give me the rights to do. So just 6-7 months trying to get them to give an amendment. Right. And we're like one line away, and I'm still waiting for weeks for that. I got the narrator ready. So but they've agreed in the principle. I just got to get the final paper to sign off, and then I've got it all, and this fellow is so he's so diligent that he actually will listen to and find, Look at if the way there are traders who have something on some YouTube, they're at some caption in some YouTube thing, or they listen to the audio that I can provide. So he tries to get, he's not trying to copy the voice so much as try to get the nature, the characteristic of the person. He's an actor. So the thing that's so great about it is that, you know, the different people sound different, and right. It's so way superior than what was done with the original. Now, the interesting thing was that Market Wizards has always been the best selling of the Market Wizard books. First sure. one, I guess. And New Market Wizards does fine, but still not as good. You know, still Market Wizards is always outselling. Interestingly, once I had this audio of New Market Wizards, it was dramatically outselling Market Wizards in audio. So it was, you know, in Kindle and hardcover, softcover, every other version, Market Wizards was selling better. But in the audio that I produced with DJ Holt, who's the narrator, that audio was outselling substantially the Market Wizards audio. So I've been trying to get the right, you know, getting the agreement, which I'm very close to getting. And once I get that, he's all set to narrate it. And so he'll do the narration of Market Wizards, and it will be a treat because he's just phenomenal. And and actually, I would look forward. I don't read my own books again, but I've kind of heard them through the audio, and I actually myself would look forward to hearing what he does with my own book.
Awesome. So you passed on you passed on Morgan Freeman.
He didn't audition. I do like Morgan Freeman. I would have considered him, but he didn't audition.
All right. A couple more questions here. Now, Jack, I want to ask you about your take on the newest and hottest investments going forward. There's a lot going on. You know, we went through the .com, and now we've seen Bitcoin run the scale, pull back. It seems like it's a little ever since the exchange got involved, it's a little regulated a little bit. What do you think might be some of the newest and hottest investments going forward here?
I don't know newest and hottest. I think the standard investments will remain and remain the key ones. As far as all the cryptocurrencies, I think probably a lot of them will go to zero. I'm almost sure. My initial inclination was to think it's all, you know, when I see a market go from 1,000 to 20,000 in 1 year, my initial impression is, you know, it's a bubble, you know. And given nature, I guess it's still that, and I was tempted with, I honestly, seriously thought about going short the first night when it started trading on futures. But I said, I really don't know anything. I'm not going to sell into. I mean, if I was going to do anything, I was tempted because I thought that it's. But and of course, it's going down a lot since then. But the only qualm I have about it being a complete bubble is that it has a function in the black market, both for stuff like illicit drug trading and also for ways for people from corrupt countries to get their money out. Right. So it serves that function, and that's what it's about. It's not about, you know, I'm no expert. I know nothing about cryptocurrencies, but this little blockchain. I mean, I think that's all a bunch of malarkey. That's the reason why it's going up, because banks can do their own blockchain. They don't need Bitcoin. They don't need the other cryptocurrencies. I think it's all about that. Well, part of it, of course, is mania. People, you know, it goes up a lot. People buy stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But insofar as there's a legitimate fundamental reason, it's simply because it's a way, as I said, for black money to get out or move. And so because of that, it's hard to estimate what that market is. And so there could be a substantial market that uses that type of currency. And so that's if it succeeds, or some of them succeed over the longer term, it's going to be, I'm convinced it's that, not blockchain technology, which may be the future, but it doesn't. But that could be. That doesn't mean that these companies, that the cryptocurrencies would be the ones that benefit from that, because it could be copied. You know, so it's like the internet was a giant development, but a lot of the early internet companies went bust. So they may have been totally right, but it doesn't mean that they're going to be the ones that make the money.
You know, it was like leaving a class of second graders alone for an hour and coming back an hour later and just seeing what had happened. I mean, it was,
I remember, you know, right around also the time Futures was starting to, I had my cousin I'm close with, has a nephew, and he had, you know, and this is a kid who's, right. he works for a hotel or something like that. I mean, he's not got a lot of money or anything. And so he had bought Bitcoin. She asked me what I thought. And I said, Frank, I said, look, you know, I gave it a spiel. I said, bottom line, I said, if you ask me, and I think at that time it was like 17 or 18,000. I said, if you ask me, if I was going to go one way or the other, I'd be short. I mean, that's all I can tell you. I don't know. It could go to 100, sure, but it could go to zero too. You know, so I said, if you ask me to me, what struck me was, here's a kid who knows nothing about finance and he's buying Bitcoin. I mean, that can't be good.
Yeah, my son did the same thing with Ethereum. I'm like, why don't you ask me before you went and bought it? But anyway, Jack, I want to ask you, if you could go back into time, we had a time machine, you go back into time, and tell yourself one thing when you started out, what would that be?
It would, you know, we hit that line before, but I could just tell myself one thing, it would be that know where you're getting out of every trade before you get in. Make that decision before you get in, and trade only do those type of trades. And that would be, if I could only give myself one bit of advice, that would be the advice.
All right, and I hope that those that are listening takes that bit of advice.
And I didn't know that, right? I mean, it took me many years, and decades even, to fully appreciate that.
Trial and error, you know, once bitten, twice.
Well, I got it. Well, I guess I had the advice from Kovner back in '89. And I don't remember when I started using it or whatever, but still, even then, was well into, I'd been in the industry for a while before that point.
Right. Jack, last question. What's your favorite book? Who's your favorite author?
Favorite authors is a different than my favorite book. Favorite authors, I mean, a little number of them, and it's nothing, and they're not going to be financial books per se. Well, Michael Lewis, who has written both financial and non-financial, but Michael Lewis is definitely one of my favorite authors because he's just a terrific writer. And in fact, some book like The Big Short, which is amazing because he takes the most esoteric financial topic possible and makes it compelling. So he's a wonderful writer. Anything Michael Lewis writes is great. One of my favorite authors is Bill Bryson, who's a humor writer. They made a horrible movie out of it. They completely killed it. He has a phenomenally, you know, entertaining book called A Walk in the Woods about his doing the Appalachian Trail, where he's out of shape and his companion is his college friend, old college friend, who's even more out of shape than he is. But that's just a terrific book. But in the number, he's written a lot of, he has a book called The History of Everything, which he goes through the history of science, but in an entertaining way. And sort of as a non-scientist, and it both is filled with a lot of information and lots of humor. So Bill Bryson is one of my favorite authors. As far as my favorite book, I have a single favorite book, and it's, and again, nothing to do with finance. Although I shouldn't say it has nothing to do. Actually, it has something to do with finance. It has something to do with life. It's a book called Endurance, written by fellow Alfred Lansing in 1956, I believe. And it is the narrative of the famous Shackleford expedition. Mm. Where he and his crew got trapped in the ice,
right?
And how they, you know, and what happened in the subsequent years, and it is a phenomenal story, and that book does a great job of it, and it is, you know, just testament, you know, testimony also to human strength and confidence in nature and so forth, but that is probably that's one book I probably have read a few times, and it's just a book that's my single favorite book.
Fantastic. Jack, I really want to say thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it, and all the best. Keep us posted when the release for the audiobooks are going to be. We'd like to share that with the audience.
Yeah, also. So I think if I can get the publisher to get the final contract, you know, the amendment done, the narrator should probably be able to wind it up in a few months. So I would expect it'll probably, and I have a, you know, I will tweet announcements to the effect of when it's coming.
Fantastic.
And I, what I would expect, though, that it'll be available, say, by the fourth quarter, sometime in the fourth quarter would be my guess, which would be kind of right in time for the 30th anniversary, although I didn't make that connection until you asked the question.
There you go. We're doing our homework here. We're doing our homework, Jack. All right. Well, Jack, all the best to you, and I hope down the road I can give you another call and do another podcast with you. Loved it.
Yeah, sure. It was fun.
All right.
Okay. Good speaking with you. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Take care, Jack. All right, Mike, what a great conversation with Jack. If there's one thing that came up over and over, it was the Bruce Kovner's quote. Now, you might have heard this already, but know where you're going to get out before you get in. That's been said and sort of termed differently, but all basically as one understanding.
Yeah, you know what? I know in my experience that it isn't getting in. That's the hard part is knowing when to get out.
Right.
And knowing when to get out, you could do that for anything, Eddie. You could look at your stock portfolio. When do I take profits? You could look at the crypto world. Well, am I in this forever? You could look at trading in general day to day. I like this. Not knowing where you're getting out, but you got into the trade. Can set yourself up for a lot of discomfort, a lot of expectations that don't get met, and I thought that quote hit it right home. The know where you're gonna get out before you get in.
Right, and that's what Jack brought that up. And one of the things here also is one of the neat things that Jack had the opportunity to do was actually sit down face to face with a lot of these great legends in the financial world. Asked him, we talked about, I asked him, what was some of your favorite lines and favorite tips and favorite things? And the thing is, he basically said that there was a lot that he absorbed, and there was a lot that he took to a positive venue of trading from all these people. And the thing is, I want to mention that if you have not read the book, it's probably a very good idea. It's good reading too. You sit back, relax, pour yourself a glass of wine, and read these books. These books are great books, and Jack had a very good opportunity to talk to some of the biggest icons in the business.
Yeah, he had great insight, received great insight from everybody in his history in the financial world. I mean, there's a lot here. Take it all in. Digest it all. There's a lot from this podcast that he just did with you, Eddie, that I'm taking right now and I'm taking home. I put it in my journal and I read about it. It helps me become a better trader. And I think we all need to be focusing on moving our ball down the field. I always use a sports analogy to move our ball down the field. So we're ever improving. And this session here talked about basically money management, trade management, knowing where you're going to get out before you get in. That's good to know just about in anything in life, especially if you're putting risk on the line, is knowing where you're going to get out. So great stuff here. Great stuff.
Right. And let me add, of course, I thought Jack's career was very exciting. The career's not over. He is still pedal to the metal. He's got mm-hmm. more ideas, and there's going to be more books, and he's going to be doing the audio now. I really got to give the man credit. And high respect. And I really hope that we can get him back on here again for another podcast.
I hope so, too. He's a great thought leader.
All right, Mike, I appreciate you for being with us here and joining me today. It was a pleasure, as always, my friend.
Eddie Horn, thank you very much.
All right, traders, as always, thank you for spending time with us. Please give us some feedback on any of our interviews at limitup@topsteptrader.com. And if you got some time, come on, you got some time, please go to our iTunes and leave us a review. Thank you so much. See everyone next time. Mike, take care.
See you, Eddie.
All right. Bye-bye.
Futures and forex trading contains substantial risk and is not for every investor. An investor could potentially lose all or more than their initial investment. Risk capital is money that can be lost without jeopardizing one's financial security or lifestyle. Only risk capital should be used for trading, and only those with sufficient risk capital should consider trading. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results.